The door, and in between I drink black coffee. Love's a hand-me-down broom. I'll never know a Sunday in this weekday room. I'm talking to the shadows, 1 o'clock till four. And Lord, how slow the moments go when all I do is pour black coffee. Since the blues caught my eye, I'm hanging out on Monday, my Sunday dreams too dry. Now man is born to go a-loving, a woman's born to weep and fret, to stay at home and tend her oven. regrets in coffee and cigarettes. I'm mooning all the morning, morning all the night, and in between it's nicotine and not much heart to fight. Black coffee, feeling low as the ground. It's driving me crazy, this waiting for my baby to maybe come around.
You know what I could go for right now? Authentic flour tortillas pan-fried until golden brown.
Yum!
Or vegan taco kits filled with traditional Mexican chilies and spices.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Or how about vegan potato and chorizo taquitos?
How can I get these foods immediately?
Buy Lita's Mexican Foods.
Sounds delicious. Tell me more.
Lita's Mexican Foods is a female-managed, plant-based Mexican food innovator in BC. Their products come prepackaged and frozen at tons of local grocery stores around Metro Vancouver. Not to mention they can be cooked in under 10 minutes.
Wow, that sounds perfect for me. I've been so busy lately and dinner takes so long to make. Where can I get my hands on some Lita's Mexican Foods?
Lots of places. Whole Foods, Choices, Stong's, Vegan Supply, Donald's, and even UBC Bookstore. Hey, where are you going?
To buy some Lita's Mexican Foods. See you later.
See ya. CITR is powered by Guayaquil Yerba Mate. Yerba Mate is a naturally caffeinated drink that comes in a variety of formats, from loose leaf to cans to bottles. Yes, the yellow ones. Guayaquil Mate is all organic, non-GMO, and sure to make you come to life. Guayaquil is more than just a Yerba Mate brand. They're focused on personal, social, ecological, and cultural growth through their commitment to regenerative practices, which include stewarding the South Atlantic rainforest and partnering with indigenous South American communities through the production of Yerba Mate. Visit guayaquil.com, G-U-A-Y-A-K-I.com, to learn more and find this delicious drink near you. Or stop by CITR station on UBC campus for a free Yerba Mate can.
Hello, what's up, dear listeners? You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and the show is called This Is Not Fine. I'm your host, Hannah. This Is Not Fine is your healthy dose of rage about culture, media, and society, only on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. In the studio today, I have Tasha, and Tasha is a recurring guest at this point. And I have Randy for the first time ever. Hello, you two.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me back again.
Yeah, my pleasure. How's it going?
Good. Yeah, I'm good. I'm excited to be here after asking you several times to be on your show. I'm glad you finally listened to me.
Of course. I mean, you're going to be a recurring guest too, just so you know.
Yeah, once you invite us, we'll never leave. We're here now as permanent fixtures on your
show.
Oh,
I love that.
Exactly.
I love that. That's a dream. So, folks who are listening to us today, we'll be talking about a documentary called The Empress of Vancouver. It is a documentary, a feature film about Vancouver's drag culture. Tasha, Randy, and I went to see it on Monday at VIF, which is VIF Center, which is the Vancouver International Film Festival Center on Davie, and it's still in theaters. So I definitely encourage everyone listening and interested to find out more about Vancouver drag history to go check it out. And today we're diving in. We're talking about the documentary and what we liked and what stood out to us and the different themes. It had so many themes. And just everything The Empress of Vancouver is written and directed by Dave Roden Short. So, folks, first thoughts.
Wow, what a documentary. my first thought was as immediately like stunning, fabulous. I love it. Beautiful. It was just really engrossing. The whole thing was just scored impeccably, and it was so beautiful. There are so many layers to this, of course, and so I'm talking about the most superficial layer, which is what it looked and sounded like. I just enjoyed every damn minute of that, like, 80s kind of goth art deco flair.
Yeah, and the 80s retro or punk vibe, I just ate it up.
I know. The first thing I said when we left the theater was, like, it really activated my, like, haunted nostalgia for a Vancouver that I never got to experience because I was born in 91 and this takes place in the 80s. So I was like, oh, wow, I love this Vancouver, which is not a Vancouver I've like seen or been in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Talking about the score, I was so haunted by the music playing and I was like, damn, I was born in the wrong decade. And the film was just so cinematic and just so spectacular, just the intersection of drag and history as someone who's a big history nerd and music and performance. And it was so theatrical and so campy, but also just very like slice of life and mundane in some ways, which was beautiful. Randy.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I don't have the same nostalgia for the 1980s, I don't think. But I think for me, as someone who is a part of the queer community but has no real connection to the Vancouver queer community, it was very interesting to watch this film because it is, I think it's both a very niche like film about this very specific community at this very specific point in time. But it also obviously lends itself to a larger conversation about queerness and about drag in, you know, a provincial, a national, and a global perspective. So I thought that part was very engaging because I was like, this is, you know, so interesting to watch this and, like, you know, learn more about this and, yeah, just, like, have more of an understanding about this, like, culture and group that I didn't before.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the beauties of the documentary was it was so unique and specific, but also very universal and transcended across many platforms and communities. Just a little bit of a synopsis about the film for our listeners who haven't seen the documentary. So the film follows Olive Howe, and they are a drag queen. She's such an icon, trans person, and they were crowned the 10th Empress of Vancouver, which is what the title is based on. And this documentary marks 40 years of her coronation, and I think she was crowned Empress of Vancouver by what's called Vancouver Dogwood Monarchist Society. I know it's very specific information that I found that I thought I should share. And the film follows her through different points in her life, back in the 80s, being at the forefront of LGBTQ activism and liberation, but also now that she's 69 and still going strong. Oh my god, she was just a trailblazer, badass, dope, sick, awesome.
More adjectives, let's go.
Yeah. And then the film also follows other queer folks in the community, some of them who unfortunately passed away due to HIV, and it also showcases Made in China, who's a drag performer in Vancouver right now and more one of the like, contemporary voices in the drag scene. And it's one of the things that really touched me was to see sort of like Olive being an elder and a drag mom to Made in China. Yeah, anything that specifically stood out to you folks?
I mean, even in your synopsis, something that like stands out to me is this idea of like almost timelessness, because the whole documentary is not firmly rooted in any certain moment in time. A lot of the interviews are taken from both 81 and like current, and it sort of flows back and forth between the voices of like Olive and other contemporary drag performers like back then and now, and they've just kind of like expertly woven all of this into this like beautiful kaleidoscope vision, which mm-hmm. like I thought was really stunning. There's a moment in which Made in China has this like little montage like music video mid-documentary, and it makes total sense, right? It's not like this kind of like disorients you, because the whole time as a viewer you're like, you're just being fed all these kind of like little tidbits of past, present, even future. It's really interesting how it works together that way.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that was really iconic, the number by Made in China. And I remember it was, they really pay ode to the queer folks and activists and really prominent figures in the gay community who came before them. And I specifically remember a photo of Marsha P. Johnson, the American trans activist who was killed. Yeah, that was just very eerie, but also just very powerful. And it goes to Randy's point of like how it was very universal in those aspects. Randy.
Yeah, I think for me, I was more engaged for the second half of the documentary. I think, and this is just a personal preference, I love when documentaries have like a timeline story. I don't know why that is. I don't really know. It's just like a personal preference. So like the second half, when they very much like went through this like thread of like, you know, the political climate in the 80s in Vancouver, and then they moved into, you know, like the election as like running alongside the election of the Empress, and then from that they went into, you know, the AIDS crisis in Vancouver. I think that was very engaging for me because I could very much follow like the connections between them. But I do think, Tash, what you were saying, like in the beginning and towards the end, like having that mixture of Aleve and then Made in China, it was very, I think it was very powerful to like have them and then also have them interact in the film, mm-hmm. like have footage of them interacting. And I really respected when Made in China was like, I'm kind of freaked out about meeting them. Like she's just like this kind of figure that you're like, you know, I've met her, but also like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm sitting beside her talking. And I think it was so authentic that you could see that in Made in China's reaction when she like sat down beside mm-hmm. her and was kind of like interacting. So yeah, I think those elements to me were like the most powerful from the documentary.
Yeah, right on. Just going to Made in China, the scene where she talks about coming out to her dad was very heartwarming, and how the dad was totally okay with it. And yeah, I just thought that was sweet. But also going back to trans elders and drag moms and that kind of whole concept, one thing that I really picked on was, and I don't remember exactly, I think it was Olive who talks about how younger generation and maybe millennials and Gen Zs, we often forget that, obviously, I mean, yeah, there was like so much oppression before, but all like a huge chunk of folks in the gay community were wiped out because of HIV, and they really zeroed in on that, and it was really tragic to watch that, but also very beautiful of how it really paid tribute to folks and on those like really strong figures. And the one person that really touched me was Billie Jean in their like piano piece. But yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought that part up because that also really struck me. I think that either this is something that someone said and I'm ruining it verbatim, or I made this up, go me, but someone may have said that there are all these holes in our timelines right now from the people that we've lost due to HIV. And I didn't expressly think about that before, like perhaps that there are a lot of missing spaces that we have now that would have been people to look up to, various modes of representation from people at all ages, people that went through different types of oppression over the years. Like, there's a lot to be gleaned from people in those positions, from our elders generally, and we are missing a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a really poignant thing to bring up.
Totally. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with, like, missing pieces and holes in history, mm-hmm. which were there and are not anymore, and we maybe perhaps often forget about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I have heard that before, Tasha, so, but you could still take credit for it, because maybe you told me. but yeah, I think that, again, is, like, something that is important to remember as, like, a younger generation of queer people is, like, who came before us and what did they do? And I think, to me, mm-hmm. actually what was so interesting about this film is the reminder that there were, like, allies and people working with the community, because I think it's very easy to, like, look back at history and believe that, like, you know, it was incredibly alone and, like, there was no one supporting. So I think seeing the community and seeing the love that existed in the 80s within this community and within the people that were supporting them, I think that to me is very powerful, and it's very hopeful. I think it has, like, a hopeful message, which I think overall this documentary has, like, this hopeful vibe. That's not a good word. But, like, it's energy that, like, leaves you feeling more hopeful than, I think, dreary.
Yeah, I'm into that hopeful vibes only. You bring such a great point, and I would love to dive more into it after we take a quick break. And I want to give a shout out, or I want to mention the music that I'm playing for today's episode is by Peggy Lee. And a few of the songs, or at least most of the songs, were by Peggy Lee, and also Cindy Lee, who's a Canadian artist. And the first song that I played was by her. And Tasha knows more about Cindy Lee, so Tasha, if you can provide some context. Sorry, want to put you on the spot.
Cindy Lee is a Canadian sort of hypnagogic drag artist. They're really fantastic. I don't know if this is true, but I think a lot of the score came from What's Tonight to Eternity, which is a fantastic album, and I recommend it. And yeah, it really lent a lot to the film. I thought it was really cool, the line between, like, Cindy Lee is a drag artist and obviously Olive. So
very symbolic.
Indeed.
Yeah. Loved the music, how you broke into a musical note there.
Thank you.
Okay, so Is That All There Is by Peggy Lee.
I remember when I was a little girl, our house caught on fire. I'll never forget the look on my father's face as he gathered me up in his arms and raced to the burning building out on the pavement. And I stood there, shivering in my pajamas, and watched the whole world go up in flames. And when it was all over, I said to myself, "Is that all there is to a fire? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my dancing, let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is." And when When I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus, the greatest show on earth. There were clowns and elephants and dancing bears, and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads. And as I sat there watching, I had the feeling that something was missing. I don't know what, but when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to the circus? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is. And then I fell in love with the most wonderful boy in the world. We'd take long walks down by the river, or just sit for hours gazing into each other's eyes. We were so very much in love. And then one day, he went away, and I thought I'd die, but I didn't. And when I didn't, I said to myself, is that all there is to love? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? That's all there is, my friends, then let's keep. I know what you must be saying to yourselves. If that's the way she feels about it, why doesn't she just end it all? Oh no, not me. I'm not ready for that final disappointment, 'cause I know, just as well as I'm standing here talking to you, that when that final moment comes and I'm breathing my last breath, I'll be saying to myself, is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. That's all there is.
Now Eurovision. Hey, psst. Actually, it's called Shindig.
Prepare for the ultimate battle of the bands. The best from Vancouver's musicians come together to show their talents, starting with 16 bands and one final winner.
Qualifiers on November 1st, 5th, 18th and 22nd, with the finale on December 2nd at the Redgate Art Society. Be there or like be square.
Hey, why are you so sad today?
My succulent died.
Can you even kill those things?
It's okay. There's a Dead Succulent Haunt episode every Thursday at 5 p.m. here on CITR to help your plants grow and to help you mourn those you've lost.
Come on, let's go start some cuttings and listen to Dead Succulent Haunt with Everly on CITR 101.9.
Hello, welcome back. You're listening to This Is Not Fine on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. I'm your host, Hannah, and in studio I have Tasha and Randy.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks again for coming onto my show. Today we're talking about the documentary The Empress of Vancouver, which, if you haven't been listening, is about Vancouver's drag culture and follows a drag queen who's quite a legend, Olive Howe. And we were talking about the things that stood out to us in the documentary and a bit of synopsis and themes, etc. And now we're going to be jumping into the political aspect of it because drag is a political tool, has always been, and some of our key takeaways. So who wants to go first? Tasha looks ready.
Oh no. we were discussing this part of the program being our takes, not necessarily hot takes, but takes in general. And I think it's important to point out that that this story obviously centers Olive Howe, but it also talks about Mike Harcourt, the mayor in, I think, 81, who was pretty pivotal in getting what we know now as the Gay Pride Parade off the ground and getting the permits for this Pride celebration. In the documentary, I think they had called it the Unity Parade or Unity Week.
Yeah, I believe it was Gay Unity Pride Week or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's really exciting to see that part of the story and the correlation between the way that Olive engages with drag and with pride and with representation, and how Mike Harcourt could actually do similar things in terms of just like civic.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's something that really jumped out to me. And it was just very endearing to see this person, the mayor in local politics, and Olive's relationship and how they're both champions of, I don't know, wanting to like have a more progressive city. And Mike Harcourt is a strong ally of the queer community. And going back to what Randy was talking about right before the break, I really appreciated the hopeful vibes, considering our world is can be a dark place. And it was really cool and refreshing to just witness back in time in the 70s and 80s where we were progressing in a lot of ways, which maybe we don't remember. And I don't know if it's just me, but I often think, as someone who's pretty new, I've only been in Vancouver for the past 4 years, and I don't think the city is necessarily political. And so it was incredible to witness the fight for queer rights and how drag. Olive used drag as like a political tool and also just to like shift the needle.
Yeah, they were both pretty big arbiters of change, and the way that they exacted change to us in our political consciousness or even cultural consciousness is different. Their approaches are different, but they both were enacting change and progression, you know.
Mm-hmm. And the camaraderie and just the solidarity was very beautiful to witness.
Yeah, I think another way that the film touches on the idea that, like, drag is political, but further than that, like, certain queer bodies are political, is when Olive, I don't know if she uses terminology, but, like, the idea of, like, homonationalism, so, like, constructing this gay queer body that fits into kind of, like, conforms to the notions of nationalism. So, you know, this was... It's more studied, like, I've studied it more in my classes in, like, an American perspective, but you have, like, these gay men that would, you know, dress in very typical masculine clothing, and they would work out, and they would, you know, develop this look that looked very masculine so they could fit into the expectations of society. And Olive definitely touches on that, like, she talks about, like, these gay men that would wear suits and that would, you know, they didn't want the drag performers and trans people in the queer community, like, in the gay and lesbian, you know, fight for rights because they were like, you're too different. Like, you're too much. We're not going to get what we need. And I think what is, like, while I said this is hopeful and there is a hopeful tone, that is still going on. Like, there is still this idea within the queer community that some bodies and some people are too much, and they're pushing, you know, convention too much, and they're pushing against it, that they're holding back the rest of the community from gaining liberation. But then I think Aleve has this question, and it's my statement all the time too, is like, what is liberation if you're not liberating everybody? So I think that's kind of the political tone that I caught up on, actually, when Aleve was talking about this, like how the LGBTQ community in Vancouver at the time was very against having trans and drag artists in the community and in this fight.
Yeah, no, that's so important. And thank you for bringing that up, Randy. Aleve used the term homonormativity. And it is very interesting. It really showcases how much transphobia still exists in the queer community even. And I have Aleve's exact quote where she was often told by people, don't be that kind of queer, be this nice kind of queer. And I think I can draw parallels to her sentiment to, like, the model minority myth of be the good kind of immigrant, be the good kind of, like, BIPOC person, and try to fit in and try to internalize colonization and be whitewashed. And it was really fascinating to see footage where there were a lot of gays and lesbians who were more like, they could be straight passing, but like some folks just can't be. And so exactly what you say, like some bodies, some queer bodies are accepted and others are not. And really it shines a spotlight on the double standards and just kind of the paradoxical mindset.
Yeah. And I think that to me, that was like very topical, because it's something like, you know, I'm doing a gender studies degree and we talk about that all the time. Like, so the idea that, like, you know, the argument when they try to be like, oh, this isn't political, we don't want to make this political. And like, it is political. I'm so sorry to tell you that, but like, it is. And I think that this documentary made that very explicit by bringing in the mayor and bringing in the election. And, you know, it was very also interesting to watch it because we just had the Vancouver local elections.
Yeah.
And I think that, and like, as much as we want to like be like, oh, this city is accepting, you know, it's changing, these ideas of like, you know, houselessness and like health and LGBTQ plus community, like all of those topics that were in the minds of people in the election in the 80s were also in our minds, I think, for most of us in this election. So there's, so to me, it just like, I don't know. My prof always talks about how time isn't linear, and a lot of Indigenous scholars talk about this too. And I think this documentary actually touches on that like time is not linear. And this documentary, although based and talks about the 80s, a lot of these things that we're talking about, they don't just stay in the 80s.
Yeah. We have a different language for things, I think, as time goes on. But it's always a question of, like, how do we inhabit what we've inherited? And I think that we've inhabited this, I guess, this energy from this documentary in a very different way. Like, the idea of, like, codification of identity is almost, like, omnipresent. Like, it's always there. And I think one of the most thrilling parts of this documentary was experiencing Aleve's like opposition to that, even back then, knowing that this desire to push against how one is meant to be perceived, how you're supposed to look to fit a certain movement, how you're supposed to be within your identity. Hearing someone talking about it in 81 and in 2022 is like, it's kind of liberating to me, because like, I think we're all kind of fed this idea that we're all very, like, liberated now, and there are these really insidious ways in which that is not the case. Like, you know, more eloquently put, when you're talking about, like, what bodies are allowed in various movements, what bodies are accepted in the queer movement, we're still experiencing that form of oppression in different ways. 2022 looks different, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And when the two of you were talking, and thank you for sharing very articulate thoughts. I find a lot of folks that I encounter in the city can be very distinguished from politics and apolitical. And the common sentiment is that, oh, like, Vancouver is really progressive, and it is one of the most progressive cities in Canada. But we have so far to go. And so that, in that sense, people can be very detached, and there's a certain privilege that comes from it. It's like, who can afford to be detached from politics? And for some folks, it's like, yeah, we have all the rights we needed, but not everyone does. And yeah, like, as you said, Randy, nobody's free until everyone's free. And it really, like, showcases those ideas, which was very refreshing. And what I really appreciated, going back to history, is all the archival footage. Oh, my God.
Wow.
Wow, indeed. Mm-hmm. And I did a little bit of digging. I was reading this interview by the director, Dave Rodenshort, and I think him and I believe their name is Han Pham. I may be butchering it, and I really apologize for it, but they went through over 4,000 to 8,000 photos from that time by the photographer called Orif, and they really loved to document and really capture whatever was happening in the queer community in the 80s. And oh my God, that was brilliant. There were also archival footage from Gayblevision, which, as I found out, was a gay TV show on the West End Cable 10 in the 80s. Isn't that so amazing?
Yeah, those clips were phenomenal. I was really, I can't believe it was on cable TV. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also cannot pronounce it.
No, it's a mouthful. It's clever, and I get it.
Too clever.
It's like a celebrity couple name, like Bradgelina moment, right?
Yeah.
Gayblevision.
I think it was meant to make everyone stumble saying it, because that's kind of funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
Honestly, props.
Shout out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know, any other takeaways or something that you're still thinking about from the documentary, or some things that you perhaps thought could have been done better?
I see you looking at me. Yeah, I do. If we're moving away from the political, I have just like some comments on like what I'm going to call cinematography as someone who is not a film expert.
Let's go.
So I'm going to use that word just as like all encompassing. But I will preface this by saying that I have an ear infection, so I had a headache watching this film. I found the first half of the film to be a little bit messy to watch. I think there was just a lot of shots that were like, I'm not a film person, so I don't know what the intention was, but they were quite blurry, and that's something it was hurting my brain, just in the way that they were shot, like the intention behind them, I'm not sure, and that's something that I would be very curious to talk to the director about. But yeah, there was just some shots that felt kind of unnecessary to like the story of Aleve and like the wider story of like queerness in the 80s and like this political idea. And that's kind of why I gestured at the beginning, like liking the second half better, I think, because the shots felt more intentional. And that might just be, I don't watch a lot of like art house film and things like that. So I'm not necessarily in that scope of like understanding like that intention behind film. But yeah, there was just some art shots that felt kind of blurry and unnecessary. Yeah, and like the beginning, I think I was just a little bit lost. And this kind of goes into my next point. I felt like to really get the most out of this film, you kind of needed a general idea about the queer community in the 80s, as far as like knowing who these people are. Because they talked about a lot of people who were very influential to the community and like a huge part of the community. And I felt like you would get so much more out of it. And I think there were people in the audience who had that, who, you know, were either in the community or had heard about these people before, saw them perform, like all of these things, like Billie Jean and even Olive herself, that had a bit more of this connection and understanding. So those shots at the beginning felt, I think, more impactful to them. Whereas a viewer, like I said, who does, like, has no prior knowledge of this community, it felt a little bit disconnecting when they were just throwing out names. And I was a bit like, I don't know who that is. Like, also, like, the person who was, like, in all of the shots with Olive wearing those very amazing costumes, I so wanted to know who they are, and if they ever told me who they were, I missed it, which was probably my own fault. But yeah, those are like my general things. But overall, I do think this film is like fantastic, and I'm not trying to like, you know, but I think those are just like, as in my positionality as like the viewer I am, those were kind of the things that I think held me back from getting the most out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think there was a lot of names that were missing. I also wanted to know who the person was that was often with Olive in like these giant face coverings and yeah. like amazingly crafted outfits that they were just like this silent ghost the whole time, which as an energy, I was like, I stand for whoever this is. And I mm-hmm. almost kind of like their anonymity.
Ghost
like,
era.
Yeah. So I agree. I think like more context for who everyone was would be really helpful. I also am just like, I'm a huge nerd for like those really voyeuristic shots that are like kind of fuzzy and like the ones that follow people around and they're sort of like ambient and they set a tone and a setting. And like, I like that kind of stuff. I know it's not very direct, so it's not for everyone, but boy, do I love a kind of like strange, unfocused shot while people are talking in the background. And I feel like I'm a little mouse in the corner and I'm like, oh, this is nice for me. Like,
yeah.
Talk about your cat some
more. I see what you're saying, Randy, but like Tasha, I am a sucker for those shots that are perhaps not super necessary, but just kind of add this texture of. I think of it as like this is at reach, like I could be in the background or like I could be there. It's just very like slice of life. It's very mundane.
Texture is a great word.
I love the word texture. Thank you. It's the second time I'm using it today.
Good job.
Something else that I wanted to point out is in terms of the shots with those hardcore lights. I think there was a disclaimer about strobe lights, but. Is that the word they're called?
Yeah.
For sure. I see your point about the story being much more loose at the beginning, and they're just kind of like shots from here and there, and we're following. They're just like long takes of us following Olive, and we're not really sure what the point of the story is, and it does get more crisp and tighter in the second half. And what was cool about the first half, and I was a bit confused too, of like, okay, where is this going? But then I kind of put it together of like, okay, this is COVID times and we all nobody had a sense of purpose and time didn't mean anything. So in that sense, it felt very much like time is still. And we saw Olive in super fab and glam outfits, just kind of taking a stroll on Davy Village or like in the West End. And I think she called it social therapy of like her just being out and people watching her perform and like just clapping. And it was very sweet, but also it's like, okay, just kind of like in a loop, we saw that a bit. And yeah, I agree with the names. I think it would have been, yeah, like I get maybe the director's intention of like not making this a very like newsy documentary, but even just kind of having the old name tag appear on the screen.
Yeah.
Because that sticks. And then you remember like who this person is and what they do. And maybe in some ways the anonymity made us like forget about those characters, which were also, who were also crucial. To the documentary, I'm thinking of this one person who wore that fab raincoat or like some kind of coat.
Oh, Chanel. That was...
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, but they introduced her at the very beginning, but then didn't reference really Chanel. Her in any way until the very end. So it was kind of... It was a little bit disconnecting, I think, to, like, keep a focus on who they are. But, yeah. I definitely... Yeah. It's definitely... I think the shot thing is, like, so... And I respect it because, like, as an artist... I don't know. We learned this in elementary school, artistic license. But I don't know if that's only for writing.
Shout out to kindergarten.
Yeah. Shout out to grade three. I love that. But yeah, I think that's so fair. And I can, when you talk about the COVID thing, I can now see it. Yeah. And I think it's also just like the way education, as someone who's in the middle of their degree and towards the end of it, education very much forces you to have this structured outlook on things. So it kind of freaks me out when I am confronted with something with no structure and is just supposed to be an experience in creativity. It's kind of like my brain is like, no, this is bad. But I think, yeah, that's just one of the ways that like our structured education is like, you know, we always say like it strips your creativity because it's like you should be doing this and then, you know, following a timeline, essentially.
No, you're absolutely. But I can definitely be stifling. And I enjoyed seeing the sort of like, I always talk about it as the funnel approach of like you start really wide and then you become narrow. Mm-hmm. So that's what it was. It was kind of just being thrown in a funnel and it was so loose and ambiguous in the beginning, and I'm like, I'm just enjoying watching these fantastic outfits and these cool masks, and I don't know what I'm in for. And then, oh boy, it got like so political, and all those performances were pretty revolutionary. And then we had this whole arc of Made in China, who actually, shout out to Made in China, I did see them perform at UBC Drag, and I wrote about it on Discorder. And something that I have told so many people about, one of the anecdotes from the show, when Made in China performed, and then people were really hyped and started screaming, China, 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 and Made in China go, they went to the mic and are like, but not in a nationalistic way. And I loved that.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, we are nearing the end of the show. This was a lot of fun. I love, I don't know, just nerding out on film and documentary.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a film baby, so I do my best.
No, I mean, I thought you had some great thoughts, Tasha, and also Randy, and there were different perspectives, and that's always great, instead of just me doing the show and screaming in the void.
Yeah, we love that, though.
But in the last 5 minutes, if people have any last thoughts.
I mean, there are just so many ways to tell a story and to write a portrait of someone. And I thought that this was just a really, like, beautifully well done and, like, delicately crafted way to do that for someone that is still such an outlier and, like, just does what they want to do in their way, to tell a story that is as equally, like creative and fabulous and fuzzy and artistic. Like, it really well outlines, I think, like, who Olive is. Of course, not everyone can tell their own story themselves, so like to frame it in a way that makes sense for the person, I think, is a really hard thing to do. So I just wanted to say that I thought that was really well done. And I thought it was very beautiful and it was very touching. And, you know, I have nerves of steel and it still got to me. Number one tough guy over here. I had an experience.
Tough crowd.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was incredible and so, so, so important. And I just watching it made me emotional, just thinking like, oh, it's such a thing exists and it's really important. And I love just kind of really zeroing in into like whatever city I'm in and kind of learn about all the weird stuff about it that we don't really know. Or maybe, I mean, I guess it's more on me of like, oh, maybe there isn't archival footage about this, or I don't know where to look for. And such a thing is made and is quite nuanced. And there's just so much, even from just an informative lens there to like chew on. And It's
Vancouver has such an unrecorded history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this documentary is quite phenomenal, and I'm really glad it exists, and people should definitely go check it out.
Yeah, definitely. I enjoyed it. I also got teary-eyed, but mainly at the moment when, like, Mian and China was talking about coming up to their dad, because that was my exact same experience. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is adorable. And then at the very end, the director and the mayor, past mayor, I don't know, former mayor. were in like the audience when we watched it. And so at the very end, the director, he pointed that out, that like to see that, you know, to have that story. And that's still not everybody's story. I know that like people in our generation always don't have that amazing experience. But there are so many people who are having that experience. And I don't know, that always makes me a little teary-eyed, because I just love that. I love happiness and I love love.
Yeah, good reminder.
I love that.
Honestly, good reminder. There's so much that's so crap in the world.
Absolutely.
And we need to not have hope flattened by experience at like every waking moment. I'm saying this for myself. I'm not so passionate about this suddenly.
As someone who's quite emo, that's a great...
Speaking from the emo perspective.
Just outed myself. But no, I love that, Randy. Love, happiness, and hope. Is that the live, laugh, love of today's episode?
Yes.
Yes.
Live, laugh, love. I support that.
Thank you so much, Randy.
Yeah. No, seriously. You should come on more often to just remind us that there is goodness in the world. And thank you for sharing that story of yours. It's making me happy and that does bring us to the end. This was a lot of fun. You might catch us again. Actually, you will be listening to me again.
Yeah, permanent fixtures.
But you might hear Tasha and Randy again next week talking about another documentary. Who Are We?
Cinema
girl bosses.
Cinema club CEOs.
Yes.
It's just us. We're all the CEOs.
Yeah, there's absolutely... It's just NRK.
Sorry, Arturs and film students. It is me now.
C-Cube. stay tuned next Tuesday. No, Wednesday. Time is not
time
linear.
Time is irrelevant.
And does not mean anything. If you've learned anything from today's episode... But next Wednesday, same time, 3 p.m. Thank you so much. Until next time, take care.